This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. June the 20th to the 26th is Refugee Week 2022, and I have with me child and adolescent psychotherapist Dr. Hayley Rajpal, who has a specialism in working with looked after children and their networks. Hayley's thesis research explored the challenges of therapeutic engagement with unaccompanied asylum-seeking minors, and that would be the focus of today's podcast. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform, let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Hayley, thank you for joining me. Can you start with a brief introduction about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so as you said, I'm Hayley, a psychotherapist, and I work within the southwest region of the country, within the NHS as well as private services as well. I thought maybe just also doing a brief overview of where and how I got into what I'm doing, and then a bit of an overview of psychotherapy might be helpful. So kind of during my undergraduate time of education, we were asked to explore children's literature. And I came across a book written by a lady called Hilary McKee. The title's called Indigo Star. And within that, there were some great depictions of how one of the children in the family were drawing on the wall about the family dynamics at home. So dad wasn't at home and he featured behind this thundercloud. And I thought, this is fascinating, you know, this drawing and what's going on here. So I wanted to find out a bit more about what goes on behind behaviours. So I then came across therapy. Yeah, I went through the rest of my educational endeavours to then go on to my training. So psychotherapy, kind of in a nutshell, really is built upon the notion of conscious and unconscious processes in the mind, and that we keep the feelings and memories that are too painful really to be addressed consciously in our unconscious. So a large part of my work is building up trust with young people and families to explore that part of their minds, and a gradual pace, kind of looking and exploring kind of difficulties and problems and behaviours. You can have a look at the Association of Child Psychotherapists website, the ACP, if anyone's interested in learning some more information about that.
And how did you come to be interested in child and adolescent mental health as it relates to refugees and asylum seekers?
So I worked within a generic CAMS team in the Southwest, and when I was linked with the looked after children's team, I noticed that over a couple of years we were receiving more referrals from unaccompanied minors regarding kind of the mental health concerns of these individuals. There was lots of kind of multi-layered stuff going on and comorbidity as well. As those levels of referrals were increasing, we weren't necessarily giving direct therapeutic sessions to these young individuals. It was more medication or kind of review meetings. And I was curious about that because there are several examples across the UK where direct work is happening and quite successfully. I wanted to find out really why that was happening within the service. So I then thought through my studies and having the opportunity to do some research that would be an area of focus that seemed to be requiring some attention, really, not just out of my own curiosities, but for services and young people in general.
Turning to your studies, your thesis explored the experiences of care networks providing therapeutic support to unaccompanied asylum-seeking minors. Can you share some of the main takeaways from that?
I'm mindful of not wanting to give too much in the short time that we have, because it's there were quite a vast amount, but you know, in brief, there were obviously differences and similarities explored between unaccompanied minors compared to looked after children, so Indigenous looked after children, and the impact that they have upon placements and relationships. In particular, also the impact upon the availability and ability to be able to offer care to these young people. And I think one of the greatest challenges was identifying and remaining in touch with a young person's needs. When there's significant traumas and multiple layers of deprivation that you have to contend with within a care network. So it's quite well known, I think, within the psychotherapeutic community and also within those that look after children, that there are kind of multiple layers of deprivation that these young people have to contend with, and that the networks and organisations also have to navigate their ways through. And what this research kind of did find out really was that there's kind of a fourth layer that's quite unique to these individuals in terms of the level of deprivation that they have to contend with. You know, they're a distinct group that entices a different response from those around them. And I think that there needs to be acknowledgement that young people have a set of pre-existing biased assumptions that are thrust upon them from society, from politics, from a media context as well, which become enacted and held by foster carers, professionals, depending upon their own political associations and where they position themselves within society. And that really does feed into a care network. And that can be one of the challenges in particular of providing therapeutic support to unaccompanied minors and refugee communities, because there are these increased defences, if you like. That then clouds the needs in particular of you know, really what they're requiring, and it can restrict access to support and also authentic engagement as well with others. And just to add, I think that there are loads more, but on top of that, there were sort of institutional racism or unthinking racism that occurred. And one of the most fascinating was the language. How we use language, just in general, but again, for this community, there was such a fear of getting things wrong. And words that were used like influx, words of war like minefield, bombshell, and kind of metaphoric trapping. Susan Sontag is someone to potentially look into further if you're interested in the kind of idea of metaphoric trappings, which is where we use words which can incite irrational fear. And I think there's a lot of that surrounds unaccompanied minors and refugee communities.
I'm wondering, because in your work and in your studies, you've spoken to many foster carers. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can set the scene for us about the kinds of challenges that arise for foster carers. You've already touched on some of them, but when they are supporting minors who are asylum seekers.
One of the interesting things that came out was the idea of this trauma monster that kind of was born out of the support group. So just to elaborate in terms of the research, that the data that was gathered from support groups that were offered to foster carers over six sessions, and then interviews with professionals, with five different professionals, not just within CAMHS, but within other areas. Within the support group in particular, this idea of a trauma monster came about, where there were kind of a multitude of facets, such as like greed, emotional burden, fear, and this idea of needing to kind of defend against something that could be quite frightening or shocking or contagious, that these young people were bringing into a foster care environment. Not necessarily that they were frightening or shocking in themselves as individuals or as young people, but what they had been through and their experiences could be quite overwhelming, and how then a family would respond to that or feel supported or not supported by social care services to engage with that was something that was spoken about. There are so many gaps in knowledge for foster carers looking after and supporting these young people. They come with very little information about their histories and where they've come from, their date of birth, confusion around their names, for example. And naturally, what we do as human beings is we try to fill the gaps when we don't have knowledge. And that led to miscommunications and misunderstandings, a lot of complexities then added to what was hoped for, I suppose, within those foster care dynamics of wanting to invite these young people in, but then not really being sure of who they had and what would be right for them in supporting them with their needs. They felt uninformed and out of touch, and sometimes as a result of that, they wanted to have more control over what the young people were doing or where they were going, because they didn't have that knowledge. There was also a real big conflict within foster carers of whether they could be mothers or were seen as mothers, or whether they had to be professionals, and that they were encouraged to be kind of more maternal and accepting and having these children as their own within the family, but at the same time being told not to get too attached, because these children were going to be moving on at some point. And that was a real dichotomy for them and a struggle.
Did it make it harder to place the children, because there's this sense almost that there's too much to hold almost for foster carers?
I think for some, I think there was a bit of a question of whether they could do it long term, or whether they'd signed up for this. And also, again, the image that they were so often by the media is that there's these children, small children in these news images that are looking for homes, and then actually the children that were placed with them were 15, 16, 17 year olds, and maybe questionable if they were adults or not. Again, that's another thing that these young people have to face when they're coming in the country. There's so many questions of who they are and where they've come from. So I think for some it was a bit of a challenge of whether they could continue fostering unaccompanied minors, or whether, you know, they wanted to, looking back, whether they should have got into that in the first place. But on the flip side, this study did explore the challenges, but there was love, there was hopefulness that came within this group too. And the idea of wanting to, you know, do a good enough job. And even the question of adoption came up too, of really wanting to accept some of these young people. And one family in particular, one mum, you know, really wanted to adopt her child, the child that she had with her, because he, you know, his family had abandoned him. Yeah, that kind of, I suppose, in brief, paints a bit of a picture of what it was like in foster placement, and again, what was brought to the group.
So there was a line from your research, Hayley, that really stood out to me. It talks about the flight to normalise behaviours and for professionals to position themselves in the shoes of the other, presumably done in a very well-intentioned way, but you found it dulled down the ambiguity and trauma. Can you elaborate? What did you spot?
I think you're right. I think in many ways this was perhaps done with good intentions and to try to understand what it might have been like for a young person, so that there was a level of empathy, you could say. But when considering the levels of trauma that is often present, I think another viewpoint could be that by going into oneself to try and understand a situation or emotion, it prohibits us from being open to be able to listen and feel and be in touch with the individual's experience and what it's been like for them. For some, this could be done completely unconsciously, you know, as an unconscious defense, I think, and a mechanism to protect maybe from what it might have really been like and their reality. So instead, you know, there's a positioning of almost in a fantasy of what it might be like, which is what I mean then by the dulling down of the ambiguity and the trauma, which thus, you know, could result in a young person feeling misunderstood and not receiving the level of support that they, you know, really do require. So, you know, it's not to say that don't do it or that's wrong. I think it was just an observation that was quite, you know, striking that came out of the study, really, from the interviews, that it was quite apparent that people kind of wanted to try and understand and make sense of, but at the same time that prohibited them from really being able to get fully in touch with what was really going on and what was really being felt.
And of course, you interviewed professionals for your thesis. What other challenges did they face in terms of the provision offered and also their communications with carers and also the children themselves?
There was a big emphasis on the struggles with time pressures. So there was felt to just not be enough time. So paediatricians, you know, have a very short amount of time to do kind of the health side of things. Again, within CAMHS, there were pressures to, you know, try and fit everything in an initial assessment kind of time period, which is about an hour and a half. And on top of that, you've got language difficulties. So you'd have potentially, there's an interpreter that would be involved. Mm-hmm. On top of that, depending upon where an interpreter is from, could have a cultural impact, conflict with the person that you're seeing and the political difficulties in with that as well. Then that's all takes time management, if you like. And on top of that, there was a feeling of trying to get it right and wanting to get it right, but feeling that, again, because of the pressures, that they weren't doing enough or weren't doing as well as they might like to have been. And again, back to the language, as I mentioned before, that, you know, there was a worry of saying things wrong or causing offence, and then maybe not saying or asking what they might like to stop getting into that muddle or prohibit from it getting too messy. So there was quite a lot of, I think, guilt and shame that was in them, as well as, you know, there was some recognition of a limited capacity to think and react at times as well. I wondered if there's a quote that I have from the research that I think is just really striking and really brings this to life. And I wondered if it would be okay to share that. So this is a professional talking about their experience that they had heard from a social worker. Mm-hmm. So they'd gone to meet, I think there were five young people who were found in a freezer truck, and they'd been in a freezer truck for hours. They'd had loads and loads of clothes on. They said it looked like they'd just gone and robbed a few washing lines kind of thing. A right mismatch of clothes, where they'd heard a couple of people had come in proper ski wear, these hadn't. They were seen by ambulance crew who had labelled them subject 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Subject 5 had a very low body core temperature, life-threatening body core temperature. But then they couldn't say when the social workers arrived. They didn't know who was 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. So the person who needed hospitalisation for the low body temperature, they didn't ask a name. And of course, they're all disorientated because they've been in a freezer truck and they're frozen and they're so cold and they're thinking and all of that. So nobody asked for a name. So that was a quote there from one of the interviews. And I think the vagueness in the account is quite striking, and the unknown quantity of time, again, the individuals have been traveling in such conditions, the names, the identities of the young people, where the clothes had come from, who'd arranged the transportation, you know, all of this stuff. And I think freezer and frozen are mentioned a few times, and they were through in other interviews as well. But I think it really kind of emphasizes how this ambiguity impacts upon the ability to continue thinking, both for young people, but also the professionals involved, almost like a freeze on thought because of the level of trauma. You know, in some way, this example, it shows the kind of depersonalization that can happen.
What is your advice then? I mean, both to professionals and also to carers around language. If you're worried you're going to get it wrong, are you better off getting it wrong or holding your tongue?
I think it's about being honest at the start of a conversation and saying, you know, this is the first time that we've met. I suppose I, you know, would want to acknowledge that I might say things that might feel a bit clumsy, or if I say anything that causes offence, if you were to let me know so that we can then think about other words that might feel more appropriate or that feel better suited. So I think if you can address it at the beginning that there might be some clumsiness or that there might be something that has gotten wrong, at least you can then come to a position where that can be repaired and you can work through it, rather than getting into a position where you feel too embarrassed or unsure, so then you stop asking the questions or you don't say the things that you want to say, because ultimately then, as I've been discussing, that potentially could restrict from someone kind of communicating what they want to, or you being able to hear, you know, the things that are being said.
You touched earlier on the impact of difference and diversity. You also talked about racism and some of the media perceptions. When it comes to the provision of care for these children and young people, what issues arise then around difference and diversity?
And that again was fascinating, because it was kind of looked at in a variety of different ways, kind of within the clinic room, within the home environment, and also thought about in the context of society. So differences in expectations in foster placement, for example, sometimes emulated a battle for territory. So there was a sense that sometimes it felt like foster carers had to maintain their ground with the home environment from invasion or war. So, you know, objects and space was kind of fought over, things being borrowed that shouldn't really, you know, the foster carers felt that shouldn't be borrowed, or there were then communal objects, but that kind of, I suppose, cultural understanding and boundaries, you know, were different. And also cultural ways were spoken of as being no good by the young people. So their way of communicating was saying, oh, this is no good in Afghanistan or wherever, you know, this is how we do it, this is better. And foster care was kind of feeling a bit defended against that. So that was kind of quite interesting. And also how foster carers themselves were viewed by other people in society for offering, you know, a place in their home for unaccompanied minors. You know, some were welcomed and some were curious, others, you know, weren't so. And so they weren't invited to certain social events, for example, because of the young person that was living with them, because, you know, they didn't want that person to come along as well. And other family members, older generations, were talked of finding it confusing, or again, I think there was a fear of getting things wrong, but that couldn't even be acknowledged or talked about. And again, with difference and diversity regarding ideas of risk and safeguarding, so terrorism and criminality were spoken about, because again, there's a lot of risk assessing and safeguarding that is higher than Indigenous looked after children in some respects. So there was a lot of fear and anxiety around that, of who do we have in our homes here, and how do we have to change and adapt our family life for this young person to fit, but also how the expectation of trying to encourage a young person to fit in with them. And that situation was quite difficult to navigate, that kind of difference. There are loads more kind of religion and faith. I think around the time I did the study was Ramadan. And there was so much confusion from the foster carers of what it meant to the young people that they were with, how they could support them. And there was a lot of kind of nighttime activity, obviously, at that time because of fasting. There were a lot of foster carers maybe were settling down for the night where the young people were up and wanting to cook. And that didn't fit in, again, with the routines and the dynamic. I think what was really beneficial was having this external space that the research provided, actually, because it encouraged them to be more reflective in terms of their internal capacity to think about some of this stuff and to share it with other people that were going through similar situations. So it was kind of working through the conflicts, if you like, and the thoughts allowed them to be in touch with kind of feeling a bit more vulnerable and sensitive. It resulted in, you know, the demonstrations and the counts of love and emerging bonds by the end of the sessions together, which was, you know, quite a contrast from how it felt at the beginning of the research.
I mean, there's an awful lot to navigate given all the challenges described. What advice do you have for care networks, including CAM professionals?
So So I would say that there needs to be detailed and specific training and supporting unaccompanied minors. Sometimes, you know, local authorities will say that they are under the umbrella. These young people have, you know, looked after children. And yes, they are looked after children, but they come with completely different complexities, some similarities, but, you know, they do need to be looked at, you know, separate from that. And I think it does a real disservice, you know, to the provisions that we then are providing if we don't look at the kind of separate things that they're bringing and they're struggling with. And I think one of the suggestions that the foster carers made was that actually young people who have been through the care system and accompanied minors, refugees, being a part of that training process would be really valuable, and other foster carers who have fostered young people to kind of share a lived experience, and that aren't, so questions could be answered directly. There was so much Googling that went on, and it didn't feel satisfactory to them. So that would be one thing in particular. And I think having a space which is safe, non-judgmental, kind of a bit like a supervision space, if you like, but separate from training, separate from supervision, where I think professionals can be supported to think about their positions within society and the political context at the centre of their work. And to recognise that discrimination and oppression is a likely reality when working with unaccompanied minors and refugees, and for us to be able to talk about that actually and not feel ashamed or embarrassed or guilty, that, you know, that is something that is interwoven within this work. And if we can name it and think about it and talk about it, then we're making a better headway, I think, with then making sure we get the support right as a team of professionals, but also for individuals themselves. And going back to what I said about the beginning about psychotherapy, it's that kind of what's in the unconscious, what can be brought more into our conscious thinking, so our biases and our internal racism, what is it that we're sitting with and where does that come from? So if we can discuss that in a safe enough environment, if that can be created within our services, I think that would be tremendous, and I think that would be really, really helpful. And I think that, again, just thinking about trauma, how that can become quite enlivened within relationships, so using supervision spaces to maybe take a sideways step to think about how that's impacting and obstructing therapeutic engagement. So what's alive within that relationship and what might we be trying to come away from as professionals to protect ourselves? Mm-hmm. And where can we go to think about that safely so that we can, again, be consciously aware of how that's impacting upon?
So given what you've said, what's your message, Hayley, to policymakers at both a local and national level?
There needs to be a call for more consistency across services. You know, really what service you get within the NHS, for example, is highly dependent upon where you are in the country. And that, you know, as a service, it's massively underfunded and it's overstretched. People are working incredibly hard. It's not in a state at the moment to be able to deliver a good enough service, I think, for these individuals. I would say more consistency and funding, which I don't think is a new thing, but I think also that within CAM services, from some of the experiences I've had, that they can often take a stance that unaccompanied minors, I think it's CAMs, but also I think external services, I should say, that there can be a stance that unaccompanied minors, refugees with mental health presentations and difficulties, that these kind of behaviours are proportionate or in accordance with what they've experienced and witnessed. And again, this is kind of dulling down that happens, as if it's kind of a normalised thing because they've been through trauma or they've, you know, had to be uprooted and moved. So of course they're going to be stressed and of course they're going to be depressed. And so that kind of normalising is really, I think, unhelpful and takes away from the individual experience again. And I think the last two points, I suppose, is to just have in mind that there can be quite a hostile environment within the UK, and there's quite a challenge at times, I think, regarding assessments from the Home Office, some of the social care departments, and with others as well, regarding credibility of ages, I think, of these young people is a real sticking point that comes up again and again and again. Some of the Home Office workers can be quite ill-informed about the impact of trauma on memory and thinking. They can be treated as adults, you know, when they're not, they're children. And there's a lot of scientific evidence out there now of what stress and trauma can do to a physical state and appearance of looking much more aged than you are. So again, as I said before, within the care networks, really the same thing of just being mindful really of the biases when writing these policies. Where are they coming from? Is it, you know, not just looking at the numbers on a page, but thinking about the individual experience as much as they possibly can, really.
The theme of Refugee Week 2022 is healing, defined as recovering from a painful experience or situation so that we can continue to live. How optimistic are you that healing is possible for children and young people who find themselves displaced?
And I'm aware I've talked about probably quite a lot of what feels like heavy material and possibly quite, not necessarily negative, but, you know, difficult stuff to possibly listen to and to think about. But I think there is optimism, and I think there is positivity out there. And I think, you know, we are individuals who experience things, and we can experience the same situation and set of circumstances very differently, depending upon, you know, multiple facets, really, of, you know, our cultural backgrounds, our family structures, our external support systems, what we've internalized and how our own internal worlds are shaped, for example. So this means that we respond to events very differently. And this is still, the, you know, it's the same case for unaccompanied minors and refugees too. You know, they haven't had any adverse childhood experiences, for example. So the trauma that they might have experienced coming over to a different country, it might mean then that it's not left an impact or had an impact in the same way as someone else who doesn't have that kind of foundation. So I think, you know, we either have higher or lower resilience levels. And I, you know, we're thinking here not just about displacement, but also loss and the other things that come along with that, with identities, roles and responsibilities. So I think, you know, with the right response, the support, the right responses are being listened to, understood. Healing is definitely possible, but it requires time. It requires well-funded and thoughtful provisions. And there are some out there that have been working incredibly hard recently and for many years.
Hayley, is there anything else in the pipeline for you that you'd like to tell us about?
I hope to do a bit more presenting of these findings in other conferences, maybe later in the year into next year. And there's just so much that I've, you know, worked really hard on it. It took a lot of time, so I kind of don't want to keep it to myself and want to share it as widely as possible. And I'm hoping to have at least one journal article published in the Journal of Child Psychotherapy later in the year, based again on foster carers predominantly within this study.
And finally, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
So I'd say, I think, you know, it's hard sometimes to think about and be allowed to have certain feelings in a caring role, if you like. And I think we need to consider the emotional processes involved, as well as the possible unconscious processes that we're having in our work and in our interactions. So I think, you know, to be encouraged to listen and not to hear what we anticipate, and to not be afraid to be in touch with and challenge some of our own core beliefs and our biases, and where these might come from. Trying to spend some time thinking about that within ourselves and maybe how that's contributing to our interactions and our thinking when working with these individuals would be a really good place to start, and hopefully something that will be taken away by some of the listeners today.
Hayley, thank you so much. For more details on Dr. Hayley Rajpal, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.